All right.
Well, good morning, my friends. Welcome. So glad you chose to crash the party here this morning. Just a reminder of what we got going here. Some of you guys are like, I'm so confused. I thought this was a men's study. And the reality is, it is, except we're crashing the party of our residency program that has been meeting now since September, studying the Bible. So they meet 4 mornings a week at 6 a.m. to study the text. And I was scheduled to come in and teach the Song of Solomon. And I thought, you know what we ought to do is we ought to just take that as a shameless excuse to invite the fellas in, and we'll teach Song of Solomon. And then once we're done with our month here in the residency program, we'll just continue on as men and create an open space for guys to get together. So that's what we've got going. So we do have some roses among the thorns. So I hope you all showered and bathed and put on deodorant. And if not, just make sure, thank you guys for sitting in the back. I appreciate you already identifying that. I walked downstairs from my little cave they put for me upstairs, and as I was coming down, I heard the murmur, and it felt really good. So I'm really glad you're here. We're going to be in Song of Solomon here in just a little bit. What I'd like to do, though, is turn to Proverbs 7. We're going to start there. I'm going to try to give you just a little something from some of the poetry, a psalm or a proverb, something to think about and whatnot. This one will be fitting for where we're heading here this morning. But I'd like to pray for us first, and then we'll dive in. So let's pray together. Father in heaven, what a privilege to be here to study your word. As I was thinking here this morning, just grateful that we have a Bible. Well, what would we say if we didn't have a text? What would we communicate that would be of worth or of value? Would there be anything redemptive, anything that would be honoring to you? Would there be anything, Father, of eternal worth if we didn't have a Bible? And so, Father, thank you for the text. Pray that as we study it this morning, that it might begin to change the way we live, that it wouldn't be merely an idle word in our life, but our very life, that we would rest on it, lean on it, live by it, and in that, God, that you'd be pleased as we adjust our lives to it. And so we thank you for the privilege to study it and to do what it says. Pray in Christ's name. Amen. Let's take a look at the Proverbs, if we can. Proverbs 7. Have you guys covered in residency Proverbs 7 yet? Well, if so, you're going to get it again. Sorry about that. Proverbs 7. Will somebody read that there? One of you men who've paid the price and earned some gray hair, will you read this for us, verses 1 and following?
I got it.
Boy, you're proud of that, weren't you?
Hey.
Go for it. Okay. Here's to you. 1 and following.
My son, keep my words and treasure up my commandments with you. Keep my commandments and live. Keep my teachings as the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers. Write them on the tablet of your heart. Say to wisdom, you are my sister, and call insight your intimate friend, to keep you from the forbidden woman and from the adulteress with her smooth words.
Have any of you men sent a son to college? Any of you? Tell us about that. What was that like? What goes through your heart and mind other than woohoo as you're shipping the kid off? I mean, I would imagine there's a sense of responsibility. Now he's leaving your roost. He's going off on his own. What does that feel like?
Well, it's difficult because he's there. He's out of state. And we don't know what's happening over there. But from what we can tell, I mean, it just seems like he's stuck in his cave.
Mm-hmm.
doesn't do much, doesn't get out and socialize, and we're just kind of concerned about that.
Yeah. Did any of you have that speech that you gave him as he was transitioning away? That you're like, hey, or maybe when he was getting ready to get married, that you kind of grabbed him by the collar and said, hey, son, you need to hear this, listen to this. This feels to me like one of those moments where a father grabs his son and says, son, you listen to me. I'm going to tell you something that might save your life. You need to hear me here. Don't miss this. Don't duck on this one. Bind these on your heart. Notice he says, write them on the tablet of your heart. Say to wisdom, you're my friend. Bind them, verse 3, around your fingers, that they may keep you from the adulterous woman. Why is it that he would talk about an adulterous woman? What, is that really the issue? I want to suggest to you, yes. Why is it the issue? Because there's few things that will derail both a godly man and or a godly woman than an inappropriate relationship. And it goes both ways. Now, this proverb is a father warning a son about an adulterous woman. As we're working through it, ladies, you can flip that around, and the caution is just as strong to caution you ladies from being around a shady man. And watch what this aged gentleman sees there. Somebody start reading verse 6.
the window of my house, I looked out through my lattice, and I saw among the nave, and discerned among the youths, among the naive, and discerned among the youths a young man lacking sense.
So what do you see here? Paint me the picture. Who's speaking? What type of man?
Older man.
How do we know older man?
He calls them youth.
Yeah, he calls them youth. What's he say about these youths?
They lack judgment.
Yeah, they lack judgment. They're naive. Why? Where is he when he's saying it, this old man?
Inside.
Yeah, verse 6, he's in his house. Where's this young man? Well, we don't know quite yet. Well, what we know is this old guy is looking out from his house and he sees something going down and he shakes his head like, oh boy. Look at verse 8. Passing through the streets near her corner, and he takes the way to her house. In the twilight, in the evening, in the middle of the night, and in the darkness. Poetically, what is he trying to say if he says twilight, evening, and middle of the darkness? Is this a specific time? Like, does he look out at 11:04 at night and go, oh, wow, this is weird? No, he gives all three, right? Twilight. So the concept of sunset, evening, and at night. It means it's happening over time. And it happens at any of these times. He's making the observation that while this man is passing through her corner and near her house, who's her? We don't know yet. We don't know yet. What we're going to find is she represents any name in this context of the type of woman that in verse 10 would show up like this. And behold, a woman comes to meet him, dressed as a harlot and cunning in heart. She is boisterous and rebellious, and her feet do not remain at home. By the way, ladies, there's a lot of things that you could be accused of. This is not a good reputation. Boisterous and loud. Do any contrasts of passages come to mind? What's the godly woman like?
Gentle and quiet spirit.
Peter talks about that a woman's beauty shouldn't merely be the external braiding of hair, wearing of gold jewelry, and putting on of dresses. Merely. It doesn't mean it can't be that. It doesn't mean we ought to make our own clothes, never wear makeup, and try to be as homely and ugly as we can. That's not what it says. But it shouldn't merely be those things. So it's okay to get dressed up. Ladies, it's okay to feel beautiful. It's okay to wear nice things. But it shouldn't merely be that. He said, but the true beauty of a woman is the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit that's precious in the sight of God. This woman is not that. And he's making the strong contrast. Now, verse 12, she's in the streets. She's in the squares. She lurks at every corner. This is not a specific interaction. He's telling you about a general principle, if you will. Verse 13, so she seizes him and kisses him, and with a brazen face, she says to him, I was due to offer peace offerings, and today I've paid my vows. Therefore, I've come out to meet you, to seek your presence earnestly, and I have found you. What's happening here in verses 13 and following? What do you see?
Is that bad theology?
Yeah, bad theology. Now, interestingly enough, why would she say, I've offered my peace offering. Today I've paid my vows. What's the equivalent today?
Church.
Say again?
I went to church.
Oh, I go to church. Oh, I know the Lord. Oh, I'm a Christian. And she finds him.
She's speaking his language.
Yes. Yes. And what man among us wouldn't love for a beautiful woman to say, I came to find you, and I sought you, and I want to be with you. And she grabs him and initiates now this encounter. She came to seek him, and she's speaking, to your point, speaking his language. And there's something, to be candid, very intoxicating about that. This guy's very flattered by that. Notice what she says. I have spread my couch with coverings, with the colored linens of Egypt. What's the equivalent of that today? When you spread your bed with linens, fine linens. She's like, I got satin sheets. I got a beautiful bed ready for us. Notice I've sprinkled my bed with myrrh and aloes and cinnamon. I've got a nice candle burning to make our experience fragrant. Come, let us drink our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with caresses. Who's the focal point of verse 18? It's selfish. Let us delight in our, us, me, you, I. No thought of the Lord, no thought of God, no thought of propriety. It's selfish. Be mindful that extramarital physical contact is always selfish. It's always about you. It's never about God. It's always about us getting our needs met. Now, she already in verse 11, we know that her feet does not remain at home. But I want you to notice verse 19. Somebody read that there, 19 and following.
For my husband is not at home. He has gone on a long journey. He has taken a bag of money with him. At the full moon, he will come home.
Not only is he gone, but she knows where he's at and how long he's going to be gone. It's her way of saying, we got time. I got this all planned out. We've got plenty of time. And now, verse 21, with her many persuasions, she entices him. And with her flattering lips, she seduces him. And in that moment, everything feels right. Can I just make an observation? It will always feel right in the moment. Always. And he now, like an idiot, is at her front door. He's at her corner. He's around her. Here comes the situation now. She seeks him. She finds him. She was looking for him. And he's now thinking, man, I'm a big deal. This is great. Her husband's gone. That's fine. What are we going to do? Let's go for it. Sounds good. And now in verse 22, watch the consequence. Suddenly. Do any of your Bibles have a word other than suddenly?
All at once.
All at once. There is no partial. Suddenly. Watch what happens. Suddenly, he follows her as an ox who goes to the slaughter. In the moment, it always feels right. But boy, once you've partook of the forbidden fruit, once you've indulged your flesh, what's the consequence? The wages of sin is death. It was, it is, and it always will be. I wish we could do it, but I don't know that we have the freedom to. But I wish for those of you who've been here, I wish we could have you share your story and say, let me tell you what death feels like. As a man indulged with a woman he met on Facebook, one thing led to another. They began to rendezvous. Next thing you know, an ox went to the slaughter. Or the guy who meets a girl out at work. She starts flirting with him. It's kind of casual at first. He's married, so it's not going to go anywhere. Until over time, his wife's not as attractive and not as sweet as she once was. This other girl always looks beautiful and is always very kind to him. Starts talking about how proud of him she is, and how he's so talented, and he's so funny, and he's so gifted, and he's got so much going for him. And boy, his wife never tells him that. In fact, at home, his wife's always nagging him, so he just keeps wanting to play golf with the buddies. You know, and while he's playing golf with the buddies, his friend, who also has had an affair, goes, oh, man, you know, hey, what's the big deal? You know, just a little something on the side. You ought to call that girl. Your wife doesn't even care anyway. I mean, it's probably heading to divorce anyway, so you may as well. And suddenly, he's going to follow her as an ox goes to the slaughter. I wish I could have men tell you of the death that comes from that, because that's exactly what occurs in this situation. Until an arrow pierces him through his liver, and a bird hastens to the snare, he does not know that it will cost him everything. Everything. You know, the difficulty, right, with sin is we don't typically in the moment have the opportunity to count the cost. If a guy would know that this initial interaction on Facebook is going to lead down the road to me losing my marriage, losing my credibility with my kids, losing my credibility in the community, losing my house, losing my character, losing my dignity. If this one decision, if he would know that that's all it would cost him, you think he'd do it? Probably not. But the cost comes at the end. And what happens is we put ourselves in situations. Do you notice that? It's a situational thing. Is it her fault that he's where he is? Whose fault is it that he's where he is? I see some of you nodding. Whose fault is it? It's his fault. Look, when we're tempted, don't say God is tempting you, James says, because God doesn't tempt us. He says each one of us is tempted when we're led away and enticed by our own lust. So be mindful. The problem's not culture. The problem's not women's fashion. The problem's not the internet. The problem's not shady women on Facebook, or shady men for that matter. The problem's you. Problem's you. You know, the reason I bring up Facebook is my father-in-law, 33 years into marriage, I get a call from Durant, Oklahoma, and my mother-in-law is crying. I said, what's going on? She said, Gary left. He met a woman on Facebook and left. I said, what? So we get on the plane, we fly out to Durant, and so this is Jen's mom and stepdad. I go, what's going on? He says, well, I'm just not happy. And, well, it's just, you know, the marriage, I wasn't giving her what she needed anyway, and she's probably better off, and I found a woman, and so we're now together, you know. So sure enough, he left. So we go out for Christmas this last year, and he wants to get together for Christmas. And I'm going, what do you mean by get together? Who's we? Because I'm not sure I want to hang out with the adulterous woman who just blew up my wife's family. No disrespect, and I understand trying to be light in dark places, but I had a hard time with that. He goes, no, no, it'll just be me. I go, okay, so we get together at a restaurant. And Christmas was done in a restaurant in Durant, Oklahoma, while he's giving gifts to my kids written by his adulterous girl. And I'm thinking to myself, this ain't right. This ain't the way it's supposed to be. So be mindful of situations, okay? Turn now to Song of Solomon. Now, we're walking through Song of Solomon, and we're into the portion. I'm going to finish the attraction piece with verse 7 of chapter 1. By the way, if Song of Solomon is a new book for you, go to the table of contents. Just find the page number because it's tiny, and it's tucked in the middle of your Old Testament. So do what you can there to track it down. But it is an obscure book in your Old Testament written by Solomon to show us marital love and romance. And I'm going to wrap up the attraction piece and then get into dating. Now, some of you fellas are like, look, I've been married for 25, 30 years. It's a little late for this. I say, yeah, it's a little late for you, but it ain't about just you. It's also about those young studs who are looking at you because you've paid the dumb tax and are going to ask you for some advice. And I want to see if we can equip you with some biblical wisdom so that when they ask you, you can point them to the text. So how many of you are single in here? Just raise your hand. Single meaning I'm not married. You raise your real hand. You can be proud of that. It's a good thing. How many of you are married? All right. So we've got a good cross section here. As we walk through attraction in chapter 1, a couple things we saw. One is that this guy, his name was like purified oil. His name was used like for temple worship. When people thought of him, his reputation wasn't a beer drinking, bench pressing, you know, Speedo wearing dude, thankfully. His reputation was godliness. When she thought about him, she thought about God. Now, her reputation was one that physically she's understated. She says, don't look at me, I'm sunburned. I'm just a hardworking, submissive girl. That's all I got going, right? And as they begin to spend time together, you're going to watch that this godly, character-driven dude and this hard-working woman are going to begin to now attract in a profound way. Just a side note, we talked a little bit about this, I think, last week, but if not, let me restate it. When I think about how I fell in love with my wife, it really wasn't when she was at her best. It's when she was at her worst. But when she was at her worst, I saw it as the best. Let me tell you what I mean. We went on a mission trip to Mexico, and I remember watching her. My wife wore jean overalls and a flannel shirt every single day. That she just didn't care about fashion, wasn't really into that. She just was as homely dressed from the thrift store as you can come, and I thought it was beautiful. Because I'm like, who's that? Because it exuded so much confidence to just go, look, I don't, and what she was saying is, I don't really care what you think. I'm not here for you. I'm here for the kids. And so sure enough, she'd get out there with those kids. She's wrestling around with those kids, dirt everywhere, dust everywhere, and she's just smiling. She's always been a hummingbird, always. When she's around, she is so beautiful to be around. Everybody loves seeing her, but don't blink, she's gone. When she walks into a room, just for those of you who know my wife, just watch her. Because she'll walk in and the people she's around are smiling and she's smiling, and you'll turn around and you'll go to say something to her and she's already over in another group. She's just moved on. That's my wife. That's what she does. But she, in that mission trip experience, working with those kids, was dirty and all dusty and picking lice out of her teammates' hair. She didn't even care. Wiping boogers off of kids. And I remember thinking to myself, now that's attractive. It seems counterintuitive. Because culturally, we look at attraction as being merely external. And I want to tell you, to a godly guy, it's not external. It's internal. And girls, if you'll develop, ladies, if you'll develop the beauty that is inside, you're going to find godly guys paying attention to that even more than just the outside. Just a heads up there. And fellas, the challenge for you is if you find yourself drawn merely to eye candy, merely to a girl who's beautiful on the outside, you're going to find yourself regretting that decision later. I'll tell you why here in just a minute. So this couple begins to date, or excuse me, begins to attract. Let me give you three problems, by the way, with looks-based attraction. The first problem with looks-based attraction is that looks don't last. Some of y'all know exactly what I mean by that. Looks don't last. I mean, I don't know about you fellas, but I felt and looked a lot different when I got married than I do now. And I share this story often, but I was always terrified of back hair. I mean, some of you had it forever. For me, I'm like, no back hair, no way, right? Sure enough, this was years ago now, but I was getting dressed, and I kind of looked back. I'm like, what is that? And I looked back there, I had this like patch of hair on my back. I'm like, oh, man, I got back hair. So literally said it out loud. I'm looking. I'm like, oh, come on. And as I went to look for it, my back fat creased. I'm thinking, man, I could like hold a pen in there and sign it, you know, something. And I'm like, what in the world? And I'm looking at myself, and I grabbed my love handles, and I shook them, and everything shook. I'm thinking, man, what happened to you? Meanwhile, I hear a giggle from the other room. And my wife is sitting on the bed in the other room laughing at me. We realize looks don't last. And if you attract based on externals, at some point, you or the person you're with is going to be very disappointed. Second problem with looks-based attraction is looks can be deceiving. Looks can be deceiving. Proverbs 31:30 says, charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord, boy, she shall be praised. There's something about looks that can either communicate the beauty that's inside or mask what you're really trying to hide. You ever seen somebody like that who is so externally done up that you wonder what's really going on? You ever feel that? You see someone who on the outside looks beautiful, but on the inside they open their mouth and you're like, whoa, who even talks like that, right? I like to refer to it as like polishing a turd. Like you can do it. I mean, it could look polished on the outside, but it's just covering nasty on the inside, right? Final thing. You're welcome for that, by the way. Final thing. Looks are always canceled out by character. Always. Proverbs 11:22 says, "A ring of gold in a swine's snout, as a ring of gold in a swine's snout, so is a beautiful woman who lacks discretion." So looks are always canceled out by character. I've never met anyone who's sad that their spouse is so faithful, but they're just ugly and they're just tired of looking at them. No, looks are always canceled out by character. Character always wins in the end over looks, all right? Now, two final issues before we move on to dating. And the question was brought up last week. In verse 7, she says, "O you whom my soul loved, where do you pass your flocks? Where do you make it lie down at noon? For why should I be like one who veils herself beside the flocks of your companions?" The question was asked, is it appropriate for a girl to initiate with a guy? In verse 7, this girl is wanting to find out, where are you going to be that I might see you? And I made the observation, I think it was either last week in our time or maybe after with the residents. I think there's a difference between putting yourself where godly people are and initiating to try to have a relationship with somebody. Let me tell you the difference. When Jen started spending time with me, we had a coffee shop in Texas. And me and Shay and Mike and a bunch of other dudes would clean it. That was kind of our job. And Jen, whose last name was Gibran, her maiden name was Gibran, so everybody called her Z. Z would show up, and Z always had three or four girls that were with her. And Z started showing up. I'm like, She'd never done this before. What's she doing? And she's just flying in, you know, with her girls, and we're cleaning, and they start helping, and then the next week she was there again. And the next week she was there again. And now I'm going, this is fishy. We've been doing this for weeks. Not a single girl ever come by. Now here she comes. Sure enough, looking back now, I fell in love with my wife over the smell of a dirty mop and pine saw. While we were working together, I thought, man, this is the right type of girl. And she put herself in a position where godly people were. But that's different than initiating. I'll tell you a quick story, too. Any of you know Bill Nixon, by chance? Bill's a guy in town, was involved with Clovis Unified forever. He had a daughter named Casey, and I thought she was fantastic in high school. So I wanted to date her. So I called, and I said, hey, Bill. And I said, is Casey there? No, she's not. I said, well, Mr. Nixon, could you have her call me? He goes, oh, no, Brad, my daughter doesn't call boys. I remember thinking, okay, I mean, that's fine. And I hung up. I'm thinking, what decade are you living in? Like, that's crazy. He's brilliant. Here's what he knew. He knew that as a dating, as a single person, you're creating patterns for who you're going to be when you're married. So if you are a woman who initiates, then you're probably in a marriage going to be a woman who continually initiates. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but if you're a guy and she always initiates, if she initiates, you probably won't. Which means what you're doing is creating a pattern and giving women a permission, if you will, to be so aggressive that they'll usurp their husbands, and giving men permission that because they're going to initiate like mom initiated, the men are going to stay boys and marry mom and become passive men. And in my opinion, and this is my opinion, this is not from the Lord per se, this is my opinion, I think we need to break that cycle. I think boys need to grow up and become men and begin to initiate. I think men need to take the lead. I think men need to call the women. I think ladies, you ought to be able to just guard your heart and let godly men pursue, and if they won't pursue, do not lower your standards. Because I've seen too many women who have great standards, but nobody initiates, and so they lower them. It's like selling a home, and nobody buys. There's no nibble, so they lower it. Nobody nibbles, so they lower it. I'm like, how low do you have to go? Better to be single than be stuck with a sorry dude, right? And I mentioned this, the only thing worse than being single, wishing you were married, is being married, wishing you were single. So I would caution the issue of ladies, you taking the initiative with men. I would caution that because I think it creates a bad pattern. He needs to learn how to lead. And if you lead, he won't. All right. And fellas, let's remember that the problem is twofold. One is the problem that we don't have men that are becoming godly. And if they do, we don't have men that are initiating. And so I would say, fellas, take the initiative. If you see a woman that you'd like to spend some time with, relax. You're not buying a ring. You're just buying dinner. All right, so pick up a couple extra bucks, you know, picking up another shift. Go buy her a nice meal. She deserves it. We'll talk about dating here in just a minute. All right, here's the other problem with girls initiating, and I think a caution. If the initiative, by the way, comes from the lady, you've got to ask your question, what are you trying to initiate with? We talk about attraction, right? Do you attract based on looks or character? Here's the challenge, and I think I mentioned this last week. How many of you fish? Any of you like to fish? Okay, a couple of you dudes, I couldn't catch a fish to save my life. I'd like to tell you I couldn't. But from what I understand, you got to use a certain bait to catch a certain fish, right? So, I mean, if you want to catch, a bass, you use a small child. I don't know what it is. But if you use the wrong bait, you have a choice to make. You either develop a liking for whatever it is you catch, or you change your bait. And I would say, ladies, caution to you, if your body is your bait, you're going to have a problem because you're either going to have to develop a liking for whatever it is you catch or you're going to need to change your bait. See, if you use your body as your bait, ladies, you're going to get the attention of men without question. Men will notice. But that's not always a good thing. And what type of man will notice? A godly man might look, but I'll be candid with you. If you're initiating based on your body alone, he'll look and shake you off to fight temptation. He won't be drawn over time. But a shady man will. A shady man will be drawn every time. And the problem with that is attention is intoxicating. And I've seen so many godly girls that will compromise their character for the sake of attention. And I'll just be honest with you, it's never worth it. It's a Proverbs 7 situation. It seems worth it in the moment, but never over time. Okay? So that's attraction. Let's talk dating now. This couple is going to begin to spend time together. And in verses 8 and following, we're going to see them begin to hang out. Now, the reason I spend so much time on the dating situation is I'm not sure there's anything more destructive in our culture today than the way we do relationships, primarily the way we date. We are an absolute mess. It's designed around ambiguity. It's designed around as many rewards as I can get without the responsibility, as vague as we can make it so that nobody feels like they're, you know, being pinned into a corner, which gives me some options, right? So I got a back door out of this thing. So I'm getting what I need, but I've got my eyes out here. And that's what happens in our dating culture today. And the problem with that, right, is a relationship has three aspects to it. Same as dating, same as a married couple. There's an emotional aspect, a spiritual aspect, and a physical aspect. And they slide on a scale from zero being what's your name to 10 being let's get married. They're moving this way, these three issues. And what happens in a dating relationship is we typically say emotionally, let's get really intimate. Let's listen to slow dance music. Let's light candles. I'll make you dinner. You know, we'll have this creative date, which is all great. The spiritual is coming with it because they're connected like links in a chain. The spiritual is coming with it, and we can't figure out why we're struggling physically. I'm saying you can't have these issues moving towards intimacy and expect the physical to be back here. So a guy says, I really want to be godly in this relationship. I really want it to be physically appropriate before the Lord. But yet they're writing love letters and talking about how many kids they want to have and one day when we get married and this and that. And I'm saying, man, you're killing that girl. Because look, if you're a 6, she's a 9 in terms of let's get married. If you start dropping that language, if you start saying things like, well, you know, what kind of rings do you like? Or, hey, I'm waiting for my tax return, waiting to buy something big or whatever, you know, she's going to freak out and lose her mind. So what happens in dating is we're so vague that we allow things to progress. And I think this relationship is a good example of how to keep a relationship simple. Now, if the relationships that we were in our culture were doing so well, I'd never say a word about it. But the reality is it's a mess and you know it. It says, as a dog returns to its vomit, so a fool returns to its folly. And I don't know about you who are married now as you're looking back, but I finally came to the point where I said, I got to do this different. I can't keep living like this. And the reality is, as many of you who are dating currently or would like to be, need to hear how this relationship goes as well. And I think it starts with clarity. It starts with clarity. This couple's going to date now in verses 9 and 10. Let's read it there, verses 9 and 10. Will someone read that for me?
I liken you, my darling, to a mare harnessed to one of the chariots of Pharaoh. Your cheeks are beautiful with earrings, your neck with strings of jewels.
So this man begins to speak to his woman, and you're going to see a pattern. As he speaks to her, it's always going to be the comparison, if you will, of all these, there's a uniqueness to you. Of all the horses that are in Egypt, oh no, you're not like them. You're like the mare that pulls Pharaoh's chariot. You're the best of the best. And he's going to speak to her kindly. He's going to speak to her gently. But he's not trying to flip switches, if you will, to get what he wants. He's not manipulating. He's just being kind to her. And as he spends time with her, I want you to notice the community responds in verse 11. We've seen the daughters of Jerusalem. It's like a poetic narrative device here. We will make for you, they say, ornaments of gold with beads of silver. They approve, agree, and bless this union or this dating relationship. Now, they're going to date in community. The reason that's significant, Proverbs 18:1 says, he who separates himself seeks his own desire and quarrels against all sound wisdom. If you're single and you've got a bunch of dudes, fellas, that you're hanging out with, and all of a sudden you get in a dating relationship and you disappear, you're dead. Because you've just now separated yourself from community and you're going to start believing the lies in your head. If you're ladies in community and he comes around and now you no longer hang out with your girlfriends, I'm saying something's wrong with that, especially if he won't let you. Look, if he's that insecure that you can't have girlfriends, you need to bounce because that's not a healthy situation. These guys, though, are going to date in community. I want you to notice, look at verse 12. Where are they in verse 12?
At his table.
at his table. Where are they in verse 17? What are they around?
Our house.
What are cedars and cypresses? Trees. So are they in private or are they in public? If you're around trees, do you have trees in your house? No, they're in public, right? They're in pub. The concept is they're in public. Look at verse 4 of chapter 2. Where are they? Banquet hall. So they're in public places. Remember those three aspects of a relationship are all linked together. I've had, over the years of doing ministry, many conversations, more than I would care to have, with people who have fallen physically. Godly guys, godly girls get in a relationship. One thing leads to another. Oops, regret, tear-stained counseling session happens, unfortunately, all the time. When I talk to them and I say, what happened? Can I tell you what never comes back? I've never had a couple say, well, you know what? Yeah, we were together, and one thing started leading to another, and next thing you know, we ended up sleeping together, or we crossed moral boundaries, and we knew better, but it was that Frappuccino, and we were sitting at Starbucks, and when he finished his Frappuccino and we were at Starbucks, I couldn't control myself, and so we ended up crossing boundaries. I've never heard that. I've never heard a couple say, man, it must have been the blueberry syrup at Denny's because he finished his, you know, double stack, and I had to have him right there, and it was awkward, but we went for it anyway. I've never heard that. Why? Because you're not going to fall in public, but you are going to fall in private. Almost to the one, the situations I have where couples cross moral boundaries, it's because they're at home. His roommates are gone. Her folks are gone. They're just watching a movie. You don't want to get together and just watch a movie. You know that. You want to get together and snuggle and hope that one thing can lead to another, and we'll just see what happens while the movie's playing. Not this couple. It looks like they're in public, and they're recognizing that these situations are what cause a fall, just like Proverbs 7. So if you think that you're going to be tempted to fall, don't put yourself in a situation. When Jen and I started dating, I finally said, I don't want to do this anymore, this old garbage life. I'm going to do it different. And so we never spent one-on-one time together alone until we were married. And it's not because I'm godly, it's because I'm honest. Does that make sense? I mean, I don't share that to, you know, communicate some halo. I share that to say, look, at some point, you got to get real about it. And so we would go to the Denton County Square. If you've ever seen Walker, Texas Ranger, that they filmed that in Denton. So Chuck Norris was there where I used to date Jen. So we would go to the Denton County Square and hang out in front of this courthouse. And sure enough, in front of God and everybody, one-way streets surrounding it, you know, we're right out there in public. And girls would drive by and honk and wave, you know, and then you'd hear this horn getting laid on, and I'd look over, and it's a big hairy gut of one of my friends swinging their shirt, you know, yeah, and they'd drive by, and we were enjoying one-on-one time in front of everyone. Does that make sense? You're not going to fall while sitting on a blanket, you know, at the corner of Blackstone and Knees. You're not going to fall there, but you start putting yourself in a situation where you're in private, and you're going to have trouble. Let's watch what they do now, verses 12 and following. One of you ladies, will you read that there?
What did you say?
12 and following of chapter 1. Please.
While the king was at his table, my perfume spread its fragrance. My lover is to me a
pouch of myrrh.
Mine says shekel of myrrh. Sachet resting between my breasts. My lover is to me a cluster of henna blossoms from the vineyards of En-Gedi.
What does this mean? By the way, the vineyards of En-Gedi, I was there in January, and I was desperately trying to find vineyards in En-Gedi, and there's not any vineyards there anymore. But man, I was hoping to find them. The concept ultimately is this. Guys, you need to know that when you write her a note, what do you think she does with it once she's read it? Because I guarantee you she doesn't throw it away. She's going to put it in some shoebox up in the closet. She's going to start scrapbooking, all right, and write all kinds of bubble letters around it and keep it. She's going to save it for the most part. She's going to think about it more intimately and more deeply than you would. I mean, I don't know about you. My wife writes me a note. I'm like, oh, that's great. Thanks, honey. Round file. Nothing personal. I just don't think like that. I don't feel like that. But most women do. They think more like they think more from a heart level, and they feel more from a heart level than you and I do. The concept of verses 12 and following is she is thinking about him a lot. She's excited to be with him. She's wondering, is this the one? Is this going somewhere? Where is this going? I'm not sure. I mean, 2 a.m, she's still processing the way you looked at her when you said, can you pass me the salt? And she's wondering, what did he mean by that? And was he thinking that maybe when we go out again, you know, like they're processing, from what I understand, because I've never been a woman, but from what I understand, they're processing at a deeper level. And again, scale-wise, you have to be careful, because as you begin to move towards, I think you're awesome, most of the time, if she's into you, she's farther beyond than you. All right? So that's what is communicated here. Verse 15, how beautiful you are, my darling, how beautiful you are, your eyes are like doves. Notice what he notices about her eyes. What do they say about eyes? They're the gateway to the soul. I think that's an old expression that may have its roots even here. That she is, to him, her eyes are like doves. That's what he notices. He's looking at her face. They're spending time together. They're beginning to get to know each other a little bit. Verse 16, how handsome you are, my beloved, and so pleasant. When's the last time, fellas, you've been accused of being so pleasant? Has your wife, fellas, ever looked at you and said, you know what you are? You are so pleasant. I mean, chances are that's unnatural for us. And I want you to notice that's how she feels about him, which means he's learning how to be unnatural. Have you ever heard a guy say, well, it is what it is? Fellas, if you ever say that, will you please ask your buddy to punch you in the face? Well, it is what it is. No, come on. It's not is what it is. God is making you new. God is transforming you. So let God transform you so you can be to this woman what you need to be. So this guy's accused of being pleasant. And she says, indeed, our couch is luxuriant. The beams of our houses are cedars. Our rafters are cypresses. Most likely, in verse 17, they're on a picnic out in public together. Now, what did this woman think about herself, ladies, in chapter 1? What did she refer to herself as? I am black, but lovely. I'm sunburned. My brothers put me to work. I'm out there busting a nail. I got calluses. I got awkward tan lines. All right, don't look at me. Now, after the treatment of this man, one of you ladies, read chapter 2, verse 1 for me, please. The Rose of Sharon. You're going to find residents. We're going to drive right through the plains of Sharon. You're going to see this passage. Like the lily of the valleys. You ever seen a lily? How would you describe a lily? Oh, don't look at it. It's not beautiful. How would you describe a lily? Gorgeous. How about a rose? Stunning. How does she feel about herself now? I am beautiful and I am stunning. Has anything physically changed? I mean, has she had anything physically different at all? What's different? He's in her life. And he makes her better. When she thinks about herself now, she thinks about herself differently than she did then. Why? Because of him. Because he breathes life into her. He brings hope into her. He gives her a sense of fulfillment, a sense of dignity, a sense of honor. He lifts her up by the treatment that he has given her. Notice in verse 2, he says, like the lily among the thorns, so is my darling among the maidens. Of all the women he's seeing, he's going, sweetie, there's something about you that stands out to me, and I notice it. Now watch the treatment that this man provides for his girl there. Would someone read that specifically, maybe one of you ladies, verses 3 and following? All right, stop right there. Like a tree among the trees of the forest, so is my beloved among the young men. He is like all the others. However, in his shade, I took great delight. She's saying, look, there's a lot of guys I could have been with. There's a lot of guys I could have been dating right now. But there's something about you. In your shade, I find great delight. In your shade. Anger is a fascinating thing, fellas, because it's not going to provide any shade for that woman. This man is treating her in such a way that she is... What do you know about shade? What does shade do for us? Protects us from the sun. That's a fascinating observation. What did she say about herself in chapter 1? Don't look at me because I'm sunburned. Is she sunburned with this guy? No. Now he provides a covering for her. He provides shade. What else does shade provide? Cool. Rest. Refreshment. Comfort. Notice now, she sits down and his fruit is sweet to her taste. What else does he do for her? Nourishes her. Provides for her, sustains her, refreshes her. Guys, when you're around a woman, that's how she should feel. Safe, secure, provided for, refreshed, comforted, covered. That's what it ought to be. If she comes home and she's covered in anger, shame on you. If she's scorched by the sun, shame on you. If she's in public and somebody pops off, honks the horn, yells at her, salty at her, and you don't defend her, shame on you. Because she ought to find delight in you, shade in you, provision in you. That's the whole point of providing a covering. And he has brought me now, verse 4, to his banquet hall. And as I walk in, what does everyone see? That his banner over me is love. We made the observation, by the way, last week. This book is so often misinterpreted because we try to allegorize it. And many of you have heard that passage before, but the melody comes to your mind. There's a song that's been sung for years. He's brought me to his banqueting table and his banner over me is love. And everybody did hand motions and whatnot. But that has nothing to do with Jesus. This is a woman reflecting about the care of her man. And what that means is you can tell a lot about the man by the countenance of his wife. And I can see guys, and I see it every week, guys walk in, and she walks in the room with him, and she's stunning. And it's not external beauty. That's not what I'm talking about. There's something about her. She radiates. She's confident. She's powerful. She's gorgeous on the inside. She's esteemed and honored. And I'm thinking to myself, who are you with? Because I want to just slap him 5 because he's killing it right now. And you can tell. And I can see the opposite. A girl walks in, you know, holding his pocket, so to speak, you know, under the thumb of him, never lets go of his hand, always with him, like he's like she's some sort of like, you know, elk head on his wall in his study. I go, shame on you. When this woman walks in the room, the banner, which, by the way, when you'd go to war, your battalion or whatever would carry a banner. So in the chaos of war, if you got split up from your crew, you could look and say, there's my banner, and you'd run back to your banner. The banner that she holds is simply love. Why? Because this man breathes life into this woman. Now, verses 5 and 6 are where the book kind of starts getting funny. I'd ask one of you ladies to read that, but that might be too embarrassing. She says in verse 5, sustain me with raisin cakes, refresh me with apples, for I am lovesick. She says, may his left hand be under my head, and his right hand embraced me. And you go, what does that mean? It seems out of context. Like, what is this coming from? Residents, do you remember the story with Jacob? And Jacob began to get multiple wives. And one of the wives at one point comes in and says, I want to sleep with him. And the other wife says, no, it's my turn. Mm-hmm. What is exchanged in order to figure out who gets to sleep with him?
Mandrakes.
The concept here ultimately is that fruits that bore seeds were considered to be to either heighten sexuality, to either increase fertility, or just to be considered aphrodisiacs. And she's saying, refresh me with raisins, sustain me with apples. I am lovesick. I want you. May his left hand be under my head and his right hand embrace me. I mean, that means exactly what you think it means. And when you talk about an intimacy or an intimate position, left hand under my head, right hand embrace me, I mean, that is powerful. Interestingly enough, my wife is a hugger. And fellas, if you see my wife, you are more than welcome to give her a hug if you would like. It probably should be a side hug. Okay, I'm okay with that. If you're going to lean in for a full frontal, you just keep the hips out. That's okay. If I see you grab the back of my wife's neck, I'm almost morally obligated to fight you on the spot. Right? Why? Because the neck is a very intimate thing. I mean, fellas, think about this for a moment. What would you think if you walked in a room and some guy had his hand around your wife's neck like that, just talking to her? You turn green, rip out of your shirt, and beat him right there. Why? That's intimate. And she's saying in verse 6, this godly woman is saying in verse 6, oh, man, let me tell you what I want right now. Is that okay? Is that okay to feel what she's feeling? And I'm going to say, I think it's okay to feel what she's feeling, but ladies, you better hope you got a guy like this guy. Because watch what he does in verse 7. He says, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles, or by the hinds of the field, that you do not arouse or awaken love until it pleases. That you do not arouse or awaken love until the time pleases, until it is the right time. Good feelings, not yet. Fascinating thing about this guy, in my opinion, he mans up right here. Because she is as vulnerable as she can come. She loves him, wants him, is excited about him. As they're spending time together, he's been kind with her, gentle with her. The banner over her is love. She was once sunburned and afflicted and now is covered in shade and glory and refreshed and nourished. She's beautiful and stunning and she wants him. And this man in the moment posts up and says, good feeling, sweetie. Not yet. I gotta go. And he hits the back door. Like Joseph of old, he hits the back door. And he says, not yet. It's not the right time. Love what you're feeling. I'm honored. I'm humbled. I'm so grateful that you feel that way, but I'm not going to do that. Now, interesting thing, by the way, about sexuality. We've made the joke in years past that women are like crockpots and men are like microwaves. For a man, most of it's visual. Stimulation comes, he sees it. Stimulation leaves, he moved on. Okay? That's the way men operate. So they can respond and not respond very quickly. Okay? For women, it's different. And fellas, this is what I want you to hear. For women, it's different. Now, I've never been a woman, but I've been married to one for almost 16 years. And we've talked a lot about this because we've tried to help a lot of couples through this issue. Because this is where the rubber meets the road right here. This is where boyhood becomes manhood. This is where you decide who is ready for a relationship and who's not, right here. And what we found is that women are like crockpots, which means that, I don't know if you ever cook with crockpots. I had a stepmom for about 13 months. Her name was Joanne. She wasn't around long, but she could cook. And she was Italian. And sure enough, she would cook spaghetti, and it would take like a week to cook the stuff. I mean, it's unbelievable. I think it was a form of torture, to be honest with you. Because she would put all the food in there, right? And then it would just like simmer for days at a time. But with crock pots, what's fascinating is if you turn them up too high and it begins to boil over, look, you can take the lid off, but it's still going to boil over. You can unplug it, but it's still going to boil over. Once it reaches that point where it says, I'm going for it, I'm boiling over, you can't stop it. And men know that. Men know that. And so we say things like, hey, look, you know, I'm walking with the Lord now, and so I don't want to live like I used to live, and this relationship is really important to me, and so I don't want to ever cross any boundaries that would make you feel uncomfortable. So if any time in our relationship, if I make you feel uncomfortable, you just tell me to stop, and I will. And he begins to push, and she says, stop, and he says, okay. And he begins to push, and she says, stop, a little later now. And he says, okay, I respect that. Let's pray about that. He begins to lean in a little more. And she says, stop a little later. And he says, okay, that's great. And then he begins to lean in a little more. She says, stop a little later. At some point, she's not going to say stop at all. And he knew it. He knew it. Ladies, next time a boy says that to you, you kick him. You kick him. Because he knows. He knows. Not this guy. This guy's not going to put it on her. Why? Because this man's going to lead. Robert Lewis gave the definition of manhood I've ever heard. If you've never heard it, it's worth repeating here. it comes from Men's Fraternity. It says that, that the definition of manhood is, in my opinion, threefold. He has a fourth, but I don't like it as much. Threefold. Reject passivity, accept responsibility, and lead courageously. Fellas, you want a definition of manhood? Just live through that filter. Am I rejecting passivity? Am I accepting responsibility? Am I leading courageously? You can put that through business decisions, that filter. You can put that filter through what you're doing on the weekend, what you're watching on the internet, what you're doing at home when no one's looking. Every single situation in life, just run it through that filter. Am I rejecting passivity, accepting responsibility, and leading courageously? This guy does all three. And in my opinion, he mans up big time. Now, ladies, what's going to happen if you're with a guy who's not willing to hit the brakes but wants you to? You're going to cross all kinds of boundaries, and you're going to end up in all kinds of trouble. A couple things that are hot-button issues regarding dating, and then I'll give you a little definition of it. I find most of the trouble comes when guys and girls try to spend time in relationships, friendships, over time. Oh, no, we're just friends for, like, ever, you know, extended friendships. I don't find that that works. Why? Because there's typically chemistry, because God wired us to have chemistry together, men and women. You spend one-on-one time with anyone of the opposite sex, there's going to be some chemistry. You say, no, there's not, then it's the other person who has it. So just be mindful of that. Second, long-term dating relationships. I taught this last month at Joshua up at Hume Lake. It was a 19-year-old kid. He's talking about how he just really, really feels ready to date this girl. I go, how old are you? He says, 19. I'm like, 19? Like, dude, you don't have a clue. Not only that, I said, you're going to do what after this? Oh, I'm going to go to school. Great, so you're going to spend 4 or 5 years at school? Then what? Well, then I'm going to go to something, like some other school he wanted to do. I'm like, bro, you're talking about almost 10 years. You're going to date this girl for 10 years? You can forget it. Because all three of those things in relationship, those elements, emotional, spiritual, and physical, every day they're clicking towards more intimate. You can't stop it. It's like a tractor pull. The longer you date, the harder it gets. So if you don't have light at the end of the tunnel, if you're talking about 4 or 5 years before you're even in a position to be married, why on earth would you date? Why not just enjoy groups of people, delight in what you see with people over time in casual settings where you're not clicking through the intimacy and having to then make a decision? Third thing, I think until we're content being single, we got no business being married. Until we're content being single, we have no business dating. Because look, if I'm not content being single, what do I really have to offer my spouse other than neediness? If I'm not content, I'm going to ask her to fill something in my life that Christ has not filled yet, at which point I'm asking her to do something she was never created to do. She can't do it. If I'm not content, just me and the Lord, and willing to say it's just me and the Lord forever, then I'm not ready for a relationship. Because at best, a relationship is a supplement to a thriving relationship with God. It's not a substitute. Now, it's okay to have a longing to one day be in a relationship, but if you're not content in the Lord as a single, I think the focal point needs to be developing that. Final thing is, I think it is fascinating to me how many people waste, and I say waste, and I mean that respectfully, so much time looking for that other person. Could it be that person? Could it be that person? Could it be that person? Could it be that person or that person or that person and that person or that person? All the while neglecting the most important person they should be focusing on, which is this person. Everybody wants to date somebody fantastic, but few people want to become fantastic. Does that make sense? The best thing you could do as a single is grow. Walk with Jesus. Read your Bible. Be godly. Get overseas while you can. Because I'll promise you, they joke about marriage being a ball and chain. I don't agree with that metaphor at all. But I will say this, life changes. Freedoms change. Flexibilities change. Availability changes, especially when you bring a little one into it. That's a game changer again. So while you can, go. Travel. Share the gospel in the remotest parts of the earth. And focus on you. Be the type of person now that that person you'd like to date would want to spend time with. Let me just wrap up with this. How are we doing on time? Okay, let me just wrap up with this. When it comes to dating, is it wrong to date around? I say, well, it depends on how you date. So I would say, look, if you keep dating casual, if dating is something that's non-escalating, if it's public, if it's in groups, if it's not physical, then yeah, go ahead, date around, that's fine. But if you're making out with everybody you're dating, all right, if you're giving them the awkward, I bought you dinner and now there's an expectation thing, first of all, you got no business dating if that's how you operate. Secondly, no, it's not appropriate. So look, raise your standards a little bit, figure out the type of person you want to be, and keep dating casual. The thing that frustrates me about the church when it comes to dating is for some reason, and I don't know quite why, I don't know who to blame yet, but when a guy asks a girl out to dinner, everybody's like, oh, they went out to dinner. They haven't sent out an invitation for the wedding. Calm down. He bought her dinner. It's not a big deal. Okay? That's what men and women do. But we make it such a big deal because we become terrified of dating, and so we want to court. And we'll talk about courtship next time. All courting is dating with Christianese on it. It's all that is, unfortunately, because very few men really allow courtship to be courtship. But we put so much expectation on it, so much weight on it, it's no fun to date. And I would say, look, just date and have a good time and go out with somebody. And write down afterwards what it was about that person you liked. Not whether you liked that person, but what it was about that person. I like their sense of humor. And I like the fact that whatever. And I like the way they smiled. Or I liked the fact that they talked about these things. And just develop a theology of relationship now. And if you're around multiple people and gathering little insights about him or her that you think, wow, that's what I like. Then one day you're going to find somebody and you're going to go, wow, check, 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 check. There they are. That's the right type of person. I don't think there's one person. I think there's the right type of person. Next time we'll talk courtship, and then we'll get into this relationship that heads towards the honeymoon. Now, caution and maybe reminder for the fellas specifically that are married. I know you're like, look, seriously, I haven't dated since like Nixon was in office. Okay, I know it's been a while. But it's, again, it's not just about you. The wisdom that you have earned and paid for, sometimes the hard way, needs to be passed on to the next generation. So as you're spending time with young guys processing life, I would love it, fellas, if you would initiate with a young guy and says, hey, do you have a relational coach? Can I just make myself available? If you would ever want, would you just come let me know? And I'd be happy to coach you. Young guys, go find an old guy who you respect. You see his marriage? If she's walking into a room and the banner over her is love, get time with him. Say, hey, look, can I just buy you a cup of coffee? Can we just hang out? Because he did something right, and let him pass on the wisdom to you. Fair enough? All right, let me pray. Father, thank you for this time. Thank you for your word. Again, we pray that as men and the women here, that we be biblical in our relationships, knowing it is one of the most important and the most critical things we could ever spend our time on. And we pray that you, Father, would help us rise above the compromise of culture and to be men who lead and women who respond, and that godly servant leadership would define relationships in a profound way, and that boys would become men. So we'll thank you. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, we'll be back here next week. We'll talk a little bit of courtship. We'll see the couple head towards the honeymoon. Be prepared for chapter 4 because it is graphic.